The morning brought no dawn to Hive Mortius Prime. The perpetual smog that choked the upper atmosphere had thickened over the months, turning what passed for daylight into a sickly amber haze that filtered through the broken transparisteel of our Hab block's windows. I pressed my face against the grimy surface, watching the ash fall like snow across the skeletal remains of what had once been Sector Gamma 7's commercial district. The flakes weren't white, they were the color of dried blood, carrying the acrid stench of burnt promethium, and something else I preferred not to identify. My name was Rolf Pafko, and 6 months ago I had supervised 300 workers in Manufactorum Complex Delta 9, ensuring that our daily quota of Lasgun power cells met the exacting standards of the Adeptus Munitorum. I wore a supervisor's crimson sash and carried a data slate blessed by Tech Adept Vox 117. Workers would bow their heads when I passed, not out of fear, but from genuine respect earned through 15 years of fair treatment and steady wages. The Emperor's light had shone brightly in those days, reflected in the gleaming machinery and the purposeful hum of productivity that never ceased. Now I crouched in the ruins of Hab Block Tertius, my fingers wrapped around a dented recaf tin that might contain enough synthetic caffeine to keep us alert for another day. The label had been scraped away by countless hands, but I could feel liquid sloshing inside when I shook it. My wife Sira knelt beside me, her once proud supervisor's uniform now torn and stained beyond recognition. She had managed the water reclamation systems for our entire sector, a position that had earned her the respect of even the Adeptus Mechanicus tech priests who oversaw the sacred machinery. Her hands, which had once operated complex purification controls with practiced precision, now trembled as she pried open a corpse starch ration with a broken piece of rebar. The collapse had not come suddenly. That would have been a mercy. Instead, it arrived like a slow poison, creeping through the hive's arteries one failed system at a time. The first sign had been the cessation of off-world cargo haulers, where once the massive transport vessels had descended daily through the atmospheric processors, bringing raw materials and taking away our manufactured goods, the sky had grown empty. The Vox networks carried increasingly desperate transmissions from the planetary governor's palace, speaking of orc incursions in neighboring systems and the redeployment of Imperial Navy escorts to more strategic locations. Within weeks, the carefully maintained supply chains that fed Mortius Prime began to fracture. The Adeptus Mechanicus tech priests, those red-robed guardians of the Omnisciah's sacred knowledge, had initially attempted to maintain order. I remembered watching Tech Dominus Zerath Alpha conducting his daily inspection of the primary generatorium, his mechadendrites moving in their ritualistic patterns as he communed with the machine spirits. But as the shortages worsened and critical components became impossible to replace, even their devotion had limits. The withdrawal of the tech priests marked the true beginning of our descent into darkness. They did not abandon their posts out of cowardice. Such accusations would have been both unfair and dangerous. Instead, they made the calculated decision that their sacred knowledge and irreplaceable machinery required protection. The great cogitators that controlled the hive's atmospheric recycling, the plasma conduits that powered entire sectors, the water purification arrays that Sira had once tended, all of these were declared too valuable to risk in the growing chaos. I watched them go, their red robes disappearing into the heavily fortified enclaves of the upper spire where they could safeguard the most critical systems. Behind them, they left sealed blast doors and automated defense systems that would protect their sanctuaries, but offered no aid to the millions of Imperial citizens trapped in the failing infrastructure below. The irony was not lost on me that the very people who had built their lives maintaining the Omnisciah's gifts were now cut off from them entirely. The power had failed first in the lower levels, those sprawling under hive warrens where the poorest citizens scraped out their existence. But the cascade effect was inevitable. Without the lower generatoriums to supplement the main power grid, the middle hive began experiencing rolling blackouts. The water reclamation systems, dependent on constant energy flow, started producing brackish liquid that tasted of rust and carried diseases I had only heard whispered about in Medicaid reports. Sira and I had held onto our positions longer than most. The Manufactorum continued operating on emergency power for nearly a month after the main grid failed, and my workers looked to me for guidance as their world crumbled around them. I tried to maintain discipline, to preserve some semblance of the order that had defined our lives, but hunger makes philosophers of even the most loyal imperial citizens. When the corpse starch rations ran out and the water became too contaminated to drink safely, my authority meant nothing. The transformation of my workers from disciplined imperial citizens into desperate scavengers had been the most horrifying aspect of those final days. Jorik Vane, who had operated Heavy Assembly Station 7 for 12 years without a single safety violation, was the first to stop showing up for his shift. I found him 3 days later, crouched in a maintenance tunnel with his family, gnawing on what looked like processed Grox meat but smelled wrong in ways that made my stomach turn. His eyes, when they met mine, held no recognition of the man who had recommended him for promotion just months earlier. Others followed quickly. Marta Kess, whose precision with delicate electronics had earned her commendations from visiting tech adepts, began hoarding power cells in her personal locker. When I confronted her about the theft, she had simply stared at me with the flat, emotionless gaze of someone who had already died inside. The woman who had once taken pride in her work, who had genuinely believed that her efforts served the greater glory of the Imperium, was gone. In her place stood a creature driven by the most basic need to survive. The final blow to our sector came not from starvation or system failure, but from the Crimson Scars. The gang had originated in the deeper underhive levels, where they had initially served as enforcers for the black market trade in recycled water and protein supplements. But as conditions worsened and the Adeptus Arbites found themselves overwhelmed by the scale of civil unrest, the Crimson Scars had grown bolder. Their scarification rituals, performed with heated metal brands stolen from defunct manufactorums, marked them as belonging to something beyond the law of the Imperium. I had first encountered their handiwork in the ruins of Hab Block Secundus, where Sira and I had gone searching for medical supplies. The building's lower levels had been stripped bare, but I hoped that the upper residential units might still contain something useful, antiseptic, pain suppressors, anything that might help us treat the infected cuts that had become commonplace in our daily struggle for survival. The smell hit me first, that distinctive combination of burnt flesh and spilled blood that I had learned to associate with gang violence. But this was different, more systematic than the random brutality that had become commonplace in the failing hive. As we climbed the debris-choked stairwell, the stench grew stronger, accompanied by the buzz of corpse flies that had found rich feeding grounds in the darkness above. The bodies were arranged with deliberate care, not simply killed, but displayed. The Crimson Scars had taken their time with these victims, using their heated brands to create elaborate patterns across exposed skin. The scarification was not random. It followed specific designs that suggested ritual significance, though the meaning was lost on me. What was clear was that these people had not died quickly. The positioning of the corpses, the way their hands were bound with wire stripped from electrical conduits, the careful removal of certain body parts, all of it spoke to a methodical approach to terror that went beyond simple gang warfare. Sira had turned away after the first room, her hand pressed against her mouth to suppress the retching that threatened to give away our position. But I forced myself to examine the scene more carefully, trying to understand what message the Crimson Scars were sending to anyone who might discover their work. The victims appeared to have been residents of this Hab block, people who had probably known each other, worked together, shared meals in better times. Their faces, where they remained intact, showed expressions of terror that suggested they had been forced to watch as their neighbors were mutilated before their own turn came. In the center of the largest room, the gang had constructed something that might have been an altar or simply a workbench for their scarification rituals. The surface was stained dark with old blood, and crude symbols had been carved into the metal with the same heated brands they used on human flesh. Surrounding this central fixture, they had arranged personal belongings taken from their victims, picked captures of families, small religious icons bearing the Aquila work identification badges that had once represented honest labor in service to the Imperium. The message was clear enough. The old order was dead, and neutrality was not an option in the new hierarchy that was emerging from the chaos. The Crimson Scars were not simply claiming territory. They were establishing dominance through calculated brutality, ensuring that anyone who discovered their work would understand the consequences of resistance. The carefully arranged displays served as both warning and invitation. Submit to their authority or face the same methodical destruction that had befallen these unfortunate souls. As we made our way back through the Hab block's lower levels, I caught sight of fresh scarification marks carved into the walls near the main entrance. The symbols were different from those I had seen upstairs, simpler but somehow more threatening in their crude directness. They marked this building as claimed territory, a declaration that the Crimson Scars had expanded their influence into what had once been a relatively safe sector of the Middle Hive. The implications were terrifying. If the gang had grown bold enough to operate this far from their traditional Underhive strongholds, then nowhere in our sector could be considered secure. The systematic nature of their territorial expansion suggested organization and planning that went beyond the desperate scavenging of most survivor groups. They were not simply trying to survive the collapse, they were actively working to control it, to shape the emerging order according to their own brutal vision. That night, as Sira and I huddled in our temporary shelter, I found myself thinking about the workers I had once supervised, wondering how many of them had already fallen victim to the Crimson Scars or their rivals. The carefully maintained social structures that had defined life in the Hive were dissolving with terrifying speed, replaced by something far more primitive and dangerous. The Emperor's light, which had once seemed so constant and reassuring, now felt impossibly distant, unable to penetrate the growing darkness that surrounded us. The Rekaf tin in my hands had grown cold while I lost myself in these dark thoughts. I pried off the lid with my fingernails, revealing a brown liquid that smelled more of rust than caffeine. But it was liquid, and in our current situation, that made it precious beyond measure. Sira looked up from her corpse starch ration, her eyes meeting mine with an expression that held both determination and despair. We had survived another night, but the sound of distant screaming from the lower levels reminded us that our sanctuary was temporary at best. The liquid tasted like metal shavings dissolved in recycled sweat, but I forced myself to drink half before passing the tin to Sira. We had learned to ration everything with the precision of a tech adept calibrating sacred machinery, though there was nothing sacred about our desperate calculations. Each sip represented another hour of consciousness, another brief delay before the weakness that came with dehydration made us easy prey for the predators stalking the ruins around us. The commercial district stretched before us like the ribcage of some massive corpse, its skeletal framework of support beams and collapsed ceiling panels creating a maze of shadows and debris. The storefronts that had once displayed everything from imported amasak to locally manufactured clothing now gaped open like wounds, their security grills torn away by desperate hands. Broken glass crunched under our feet as we picked our way through the wreckage, each step carefully placed to avoid the larger shards that could slice through the thin soles of our deteriorating boots. I had known this place in better times, when the wide concourses buzzed with the constant flow of workers spending their wages on small luxuries that made their lives bearable. The Mercantile Guildhall had anchored the district's eastern end, its Baroque facade decorated with carved aquilas and inscriptions praising the Emperor's divine guidance over all honest commerce. Now the building's upper floors had collapsed inward, creating a mountain of rubble that blocked the main thoroughfare and forced us to navigate through the smaller side passages where visibility dropped to mere meters. The silence felt wrong in ways that made my skin crawl. This district had never been quiet, not even during the deep shift hours when most workers slept. There had always been the hum of climate control systems, the distant rumble of cargo haulers in the transportation tubes, the soft chime of automated vendor machines dispensing stim caf to night shift workers heading home. The absence of these familiar sounds created an acoustic vacuum that seemed to amplify every small noise we made, turning our careful footsteps into thunderous announcements of our presence. Sira moved beside me with the careful grace of someone who had learned that sudden movements could mean death. Her supervisor's uniform, once a source of pride and authority, now served as camouflage among the industrial debris. The fabric had faded to a dull gray that matched the ash coating every surface, and the tears in the material had been carefully mended with wire salvaged from abandoned equipment. She paused frequently to listen, her head tilted at an angle that reminded me of the way she used to position herself when diagnosing problems in the water reclamation systems. The first sign of recent gang activity appeared as we rounded the corner of what had been Merchant Vex's textile emporium. Fresh scratches in the ferrocrete walls formed crude symbols that I recognized from our previous encounters with territorial markings. These were different from the Crimson Scar's elaborate scarification patterns, simpler, more angular, suggesting a different group entirely. The scratches had been made with something sharp and metallic, probably a combat knife or sharpened piece of rebar, and the gouges were deep enough to suggest someone had taken considerable time and effort to ensure their permanence. Below the symbols, someone had arranged a collection of human teeth in a rough approximation of the Imperial Aquila. The teeth varied in size and condition, some still stained with dried blood, others yellowed with age. The precision of the arrangement suggested ritual significance rather than random violence, though the meaning remained opaque to my civilian understanding of gang culture. What was clear was that this marked the boundary of claimed territory, and the message was intended for anyone who might consider trespassing on whatever resources lay beyond. The psychological weight of these discoveries had begun to accumulate in ways that surprised me with their intensity. Each new sign of organized violence, each carefully crafted display of brutality, chipped away at the mental framework I had built during my years as a supervisor. The orderly world of production quotas and quality standards had prepared me to deal with mechanical failures and supply shortages, not with the systematic breakdown of human civilization. The skills that had made me valuable in the old order, my ability to coordinate complex operations, my talent for maintaining discipline among large groups of workers, were not only useless in our current situation but actively dangerous, marking me as someone who had once held authority in a system that no longer existed. I found myself constantly scanning the shadows for movement, my eyes drawn to every piece of debris that might conceal a weapon or an ambush. The paranoia was exhausting, but it had already saved our lives more than once. 3 days earlier, I had spotted the telltale glint of metal in what appeared to be an empty storefront, and we had managed to backtrack and find an alternate route before discovering that the building was being used as a lookout post by scavengers who had strung improvised alarms across the main approaches. The deeper we moved into the commercial district, the more evidence we found of systematic stripping operations. Someone with considerable manpower and organization had been through these buildings, removing everything of potential value with a thoroughness that suggested military-style efficiency. Copper wiring had been torn from the walls, leaving jagged holes in the ferrocrete. Valuable metals had been cut from decorative fixtures using industrial tools that most scavenger groups would not have possessed. Even the plumbing had been harvested, leaving behind only the mounting brackets and stains on the walls where pipes had once carried water and waste. The scale of the salvage operation implied resources and coordination that went far beyond typical gang activity. This was not the desperate scavenging of survivors trying to trade metal scraps for food, but something approaching industrial-scale resource extraction. The implications were disturbing. If a group had grown powerful enough to conduct such systematic operations, they possessed capabilities that made them effectively a government in their own right, complete with the ability to project force across significant territory. Our destination was the Ecclesiarchy Shrine that had served the district's spiritual needs during more prosperous times. I remembered attending services there during feast days, listening to Confessor Maltheus deliver sermons about the Emperor's eternal vigilance over his faithful servants. The shrine had been built into the ground floor of a residential complex, its entrance marked by carved stone aquilas and inscriptions from the Imperial Creed. If the building's structure had remained intact, it might provide shelter that was both defensible and unlikely to attract the attention of scavengers looking for valuable materials. The approach to the shrine required crossing an open courtyard that had once been landscaped with hardy plants capable of surviving in the hive's artificial environment. The vegetation had died months ago, leaving behind twisted brown stalks that cracked under our feet like brittle bones. The sound seemed impossibly loud in the unnatural quiet, and I found myself holding my breath between steps, listening for any indication that we had attracted unwanted attention. The shrine's entrance had been sealed with sheets of corrugated metal welded directly to the door frame, but someone had cut a ragged opening near the bottom that was just large enough for a person to crawl through. The metal edges were sharp and stained with what looked like dried blood, suggesting that previous visitors had not been particularly careful in their entry. Sira examined the opening carefully, running her fingers along the cut edges to check for booby traps or alarms before nodding that it appeared safe. I went through first, emerging into a darkness so complete that I had to wait several minutes for my eyes to adjust. The shrine's interior had been stripped of its most valuable religious artifacts, the golden aquilas, the ceremonial incense burners, the ornate chalices used for blessing rituals, but the basic structure remained intact. Stone benches faced toward what had once been an altar, though the sacred space now served as a repository for debris and human waste. The smell hit me as my vision improved, that distinctive combination of decomposition and fear, sweat that I had learned to associate with violent death. But this was different from the gang execution sites we had encountered previously. The odor was older, more settled, suggesting that whatever had happened here had occurred weeks or even months ago. As Sira crawled through the opening behind me, I began to make out details that explained the source of the stench. Bodies filled the space between the stone benches, arranged in neat rows that suggested they had been herded into position before being killed. The corpses were in various stages of decomposition, but enough remained intact for me to see that they had been executed with small caliber weapons, stub guns or auto pistols, rather than the las guns that Imperial forces would have used. The wound patterns were consistent with close-range shots to the head, delivered with the kind of methodical precision that spoke to experience rather than passion. These had not been gang members or scavengers, but ordinary citizens who had sought sanctuary in what they believed was sacred ground. I could see the remnants of civilian clothing, the kind of simple garments worn by Hab Block residents and minor functionaries. Several of the bodies still wore identification badges that marked them as workers from various sectors of the Hive's industrial complex. They had come here hoping that the Emperor's protection would shield them from the chaos consuming their world, only to discover that faith offered no defense against stub rounds fired at point-blank range. The systematic nature of the execution was what disturbed me most. This had not been a moment of panic or a gang initiation ritual, but a deliberate clearing operation conducted by people who viewed the killing of civilians as a routine task. The bodies were positioned to maximize the use of available space, and the killers had taken care to ensure that each victim was dead before moving on to the next. The efficiency was terrifying in its implications. Whoever had done this possessed both the manpower and the organizational capability to conduct mass executions as a matter of policy. Evidence of the killer's identity lay scattered among the corpses in the form of crude gang tags scratched into the stone walls. The symbols were different from any I had seen before, but the style was consistent with the territorial markings we had encountered throughout the district. These were not random acts of violence, but part of a coordinated campaign to eliminate potential resistance and establish control over the shrine's resources. I forced myself to examine the scene more carefully, looking for anything that might help us understand the scope of the threat we faced. The altar had been converted into a makeshift armory, with slots carved into the stone to hold weapons and ammunition. Spent shell casings littered the floor around the execution sites, and I counted at least four different calibers among the brass. The variety suggested that multiple shooters had participated, armed with whatever weapons they could acquire rather than standardized military equipment. More disturbing were the personal effects that had been carefully sorted and stacked near the shrine's rear wall. Identification cards, credit chips, personal jewelry, small religious icons, all the possessions that marked these people as individual human beings rather than anonymous victims. The organization of these items suggested that the killers had taken time to catalog their victims' belongings, possibly for trade purposes or simply as trophies of their dominance. The psychological impact of discovering this massacre in what should have been sacred space felt like a physical blow to my remaining faith in the Emperor's protection. I had always believed, even during the worst days of the collapse, that there were lines that civilized people would not cross, places that would remain inviolate even as the world fell apart around us. The systematic desecration of the shrine represented the complete breakdown of the moral framework that had held imperial society together. Sira had moved to examine a section of wall near the main altar, where someone had used a heated blade to carve elaborate symbols into the stone itself. The scarification was similar to what we had seen at gang execution sites, but these symbols were larger and more complex, suggesting greater significance in whatever belief system motivated their creation. The depth of the cuts indicated that considerable time and effort had been invested in their creation, marking this location as something more than a simple killing ground. As I studied the carved symbols, trying to decipher their meaning, I heard the distant sound of voices echoing through the commercial district's empty corridors. The acoustics of the ruined buildings made it impossible to determine the exact location or number of speakers, but the tone was casual, conversational, suggesting people who felt secure in their territory. Gang members conducting a patrol or scavengers who had grown confident enough to move openly through areas they controlled. The voices were getting closer, and I realized that our position in the shrine offered both advantages and disadvantages. The stone construction would provide protection from small arms fire, but the single entrance made escape impossible if we were discovered. The bodies around us would mask our scent from any tracking animals the gangs might be using, but the confined space would make any confrontation a close quarters nightmare where superior numbers would be decisive. I motioned for Sira to move toward the back of the shrine, where a small alcove that had once housed religious statues might provide concealment. As we picked our way carefully between the corpses, I found myself thinking about the people who had died here, wondering what had driven them to seek sanctuary in this place. Had they still believed in the Emperor's protection even as the stub rounds tore through their skulls, or had their faith died before their bodies followed? The voices outside had grown loud enough for me to distinguish individual words, though the dialect was heavily accented with underhive cant that made translation difficult. They were discussing territory boundaries and resource allocation, the mundane logistics of survival that had replaced the complex administrative structures of imperial governance. The casual tone suggested that mass execution had become routine enough to warrant no special comment, just another tool for maintaining order in their new hierarchy. As we crouched among the decomposing faithful, I felt the last vestiges of my belief in imperial authority crumbling away like the corroded metal that littered the hive's abandoned sectors. The Adeptus Arbites station stood empty, their blast doors sealed, and their officers either dead or fled to more defensible positions. The planetary defense force equipment that should have maintained order was scattered among gang territories, repurposed as tools of oppression rather than protection. Even the Emperor's own shrines offered no sanctuary from the brutal pragmatism that now governed our world. The sound of footsteps on broken glass announced that our hunters had entered the courtyard outside, and I pressed myself deeper into the shadows while trying to control my breathing. The psychological weight of our situation was becoming unbearable, trapped among the corpses of people who had died believing in the same illusions that had sustained me through 15 years of loyal service to the Imperium. Their faith had not saved them, just as my own devotion to duty and order would not save us from whatever was approaching through the darkness outside. The voices faded as the patrol moved deeper into the commercial district, their casual discussion of territorial boundaries and resource allocation echoing off the broken storefronts until distance swallowed the sound entirely. I remained motionless among the decomposing faithful for several more minutes, listening to the silence that followed their passage. The psychological weight of hiding among corpses who had sought the same sanctuary we now desperately needed felt like a physical pressure against my chest, making each breath a conscious effort. When I was certain the immediate danger had passed, I began to examine the shrine's interior more carefully, looking for anything that might help us understand the scope of the gang operations in this sector. The systematic nature of the massacre suggested organizational capabilities that went far beyond typical scavenger groups, and the evidence scattered among the bodies painted a disturbing picture of what had become the new order in the failing hive. Near the defiled altar, I discovered a collection of identification documents that had been sorted with administrative precision. Work badges from various sectors of the Hive's industrial complex lay arranged in neat rows, each one representing a life that had been catalogued and terminated. The variety of occupations represented among the dead was striking. Water reclamation technicians, manufactorum supervisors, transit system operators, even minor functionaries from the Adeptus Administratum. These had not been random victims, but specific targets, people whose skills and knowledge made them valuable in ways that their killers had apparently recognized. The implications were terrifying. Someone was conducting systematic elimination of Imperial citizens who possessed technical expertise, removing potential leadership from the survivor population with the same methodical approach that had once characterized the Hive's industrial operations. The gangs were not simply scavenging the ruins of civilization, they were actively preventing its reconstruction by eliminating anyone who might challenge their emerging dominance. Among the sordid documents, I found evidence of something even more disturbing. Crude ledgers written in low Gothic documented transactions involving human beings, with prices listed in ammunition, food rations, and medical supplies. The entries were organized by categories that reduced people to their component parts, healthy adults, skilled technicians, breeding stock, and something labeled simply as processing material. The clinical language used to describe these transactions suggested that the trade in human flesh had become systematized, operating according to supply and demand principles that would have been familiar to any merchant in the old commercial district. The discovery of these ledgers forced me to confront a reality that I had been trying to avoid acknowledging. The gangs had not simply filled the power vacuum left by the collapse of Imperial authority, they had created an entirely new economic system based on the systematic exploitation of human resources. The screams we heard echoing through the lower levels were not random acts of violence, but the sounds of an industrial process, one that had replaced the Manufactorum's production of Lasgun components with the harvesting of a different kind of raw material. Sira had discovered something equally disturbing near the shrine's rear wall, where the killers had established what appeared to be a processing station. Heavy chains had been bolted to the stone floor, their links stained with rust and substances I preferred not to identify. Crude cutting implements lay scattered nearby, industrial knives salvaged from food processing equipment, bone saws that might once have been used in Medicaid facilities, and sharpened pieces of metal that had been fashioned into specialized tools for purposes that became horrifyingly clear as I examined the scene more carefully. The stone floor around the processing station had been worn smooth by repeated scrubbing, but dark stains had penetrated too deeply into the porous material to be completely removed. The pattern of these stains suggested that this location had been used repeatedly over an extended period, not for a single massacre, but as a regular site for activities that required the systematic dismemberment of human bodies. The efficiency of the setup implied experience and practice, as if the people responsible had refined their techniques through repetition. Evidence of the gang's organizational structure lay scattered throughout the shrine in the form of crude but consistent markings that indicated rank and specialization within their hierarchy. Different symbols had been carved into the walls to designate various areas of responsibility. Some sections were marked with icons that appeared to represent storage and inventory, others with symbols that suggested guard posts or command positions. The systematic nature of these markings indicated that the gang had developed internal discipline and chain of command structures that mimicked the military organization they had replaced. The most disturbing discovery came when I examined the personal effects that had been taken from the victims. Rather than being discarded or traded for immediate necessities, many items had been carefully preserved and organized according to criteria that suggested long-term planning. Identification badges were sorted by sector and skill level, personal jewelry was categorized by material and craftsmanship, and even small religious icons were arranged according to their potential value in trade negotiations with other survivor groups. This level of organization indicated that the gangs were not simply reacting to the collapse, but actively working to shape the emerging order according to their own vision. They were building something new from the ruins of Imperial civilization, using the systematic elimination and exploitation of the civilian population as the foundation for their power structure. The casual efficiency with which they had converted a sacred space into a processing facility demonstrated their complete rejection of the moral and spiritual framework that had once held society together. The sound of approaching footsteps forced us to abandon our investigation and seek better concealment among the corpses. This time the voices were different, speaking in the clipped tones of people conducting business rather than the casual conversation of a patrol. I recognized enough words to understand that they were discussing quotas and delivery schedules, the mundane logistics of an operation that had apparently grown large enough to require formal coordination between different groups. Through gaps in the pile of bodies that concealed us, I caught glimpses of the new arrivals as they entered the shrine. They moved with purpose and confidence, clearly familiar with the location and comfortable operating in territory they controlled. Their clothing was a mixture of salvaged imperial uniforms and gang regalia, creating a hybrid appearance that suggested they had absorbed personnel from collapsed military units while maintaining their own distinct identity. The leader carried a data slate that had been modified with crude but functional repairs, its cracked screen displaying information in the blocky characters of low Gothic text. The device represented a level of technological sophistication that most scavenger groups could not have maintained, suggesting access to technical expertise that went beyond simple salvage operations. As he consulted the slate, issuing instructions to his subordinates, I realized that we were witnessing the administrative apparatus of an organization that had grown far beyond typical gang structure. The business they conducted in the defiled shrine involved the systematic cataloging of resources that had been extracted from recent operations in neighboring sectors. They discussed human inventory with the same dispassionate efficiency that I had once used to track Lasgun component production, reducing people to units of measurement that could be allocated according to demand from various trading partners. The casual nature of their conversation about processing schedules and quality control standards made it clear that the trade in human flesh had become routine enough to warrant no special comment. As they worked, I began to understand the scope of the operation that had transformed our sector into a hunting ground for human predators. The gangs had established a network of processing facilities throughout the commercial district, each one specialized for different aspects of their trade. Some locations were used for initial sorting and evaluation of captured civilians, others for the actual dismemberment and packaging of human flesh, and still others for storage and distribution to trading partners in distant sectors of the hive. The efficiency of their system was terrifying in its implications. They had not simply replaced imperial authority with chaos, but had created an alternative form of governance based on the systematic exploitation of the population they claimed to control. The old social contracts that had bound citizens to the Imperium through shared faith and mutual obligation had been replaced by a predator-prey relationship that reduced human beings to their most basic economic value. The leader's data slate contained detailed information about the health and capabilities of potential victims, suggesting that the gangs had developed sophisticated methods for evaluating the human resources available in their territory. Age, physical condition, technical skills, and even psychological state were all factors in determining how captured civilians would be processed and distributed. The clinical precision of their assessment criteria indicated that what had begun as desperate scavenging had evolved into something approaching scientific methodology. Evidence of their expansion into new territories lay scattered throughout the shrine, in the form of maps that had been drawn on salvaged pieces of metal and stone. The crude cartography showed the boundaries of gang-controlled sectors, with notations indicating the population density and resource potential of areas that had not yet been fully exploited. Our own sector appeared on these maps, marked with symbols that suggested it had been designated for systematic clearing operations in the near future. The psychological impact of discovering that we were living in territory that had been marked for harvesting was almost overwhelming. Every decision we had made about shelter and movement had been based on assumptions about random violence and opportunistic scavenging, but the reality was far more sinister. We were not simply trying to avoid dangerous areas, we were prey animals attempting to evade hunters who had already cataloged our sector's resources and planned our capture with industrial precision. As the gang members concluded their business and prepared to leave the shrine, I caught fragments of conversation about transportation schedules and delivery quotas that painted an even more disturbing picture of their operations. The human flesh they harvested was not being consumed locally, but was being shipped to trading partners in other sectors of the hive, possibly even to off-world contacts who had maintained some form of commercial relationship despite the collapse of official imperial trade networks. The scale of the operation implied resources and coordination that went far beyond anything I had imagined possible in the chaos of the failing hive. These were not desperate survivors resorting to cannibalism out of starvation, but entrepreneurs who had recognized an opportunity in the breakdown of imperial authority and had moved quickly to establish dominance over the emerging market in human resources. They had transformed the systematic murder of civilians into a profitable enterprise that generated the wealth and power needed to expand their operations into new territories. When the footsteps finally faded and we were alone again among the decomposing faithful, I found myself struggling to process the full implications of what we had witnessed. The gangs were not simply filling the vacuum left by collapsed imperial institutions. They were actively working to prevent the restoration of any form of legitimate authority that might threaten their control over the human resources they had claimed as their property. The evidence scattered throughout the shrine painted a picture of systematic planning and organizational development that suggested these groups possessed capabilities that made them effectively a shadow government operating according to principles that inverted every value that had once defined imperial civilization. Where the Imperium had sought to protect and nurture human life in service to the Emperor's grand design, the gangs had created a system that reduced people to raw materials for processing and distribution according to market demand. The shrine's darkness pressed against us like a living thing as we waited for the gang members to clear the area completely. My hands had begun to shake, not from fear alone, but from the growing weakness that came with prolonged malnutrition. The corpse starch ration Sierra had managed to open earlier was already a distant memory, its meager nutrients absorbed by bodies that demanded far more fuel than we could provide. The metallic taste of the ricaf still coated my tongue, but even that small comfort was fading as dehydration reasserted its grip on our failing systems. When the last echoes of footsteps had died away, I forced myself to move through the shrine one final time, searching for anything that might help us reach the upper levels of the hive. The gang's organizational charts, crude though they were, had revealed something that changed everything about our situation. The symbols marking different sectors showed clear boundaries between territories controlled by various groups, but more importantly, they indicated routes that connected the commercial district to the vertical transit shafts that led toward the spire levels. The discovery of these routes represented both opportunity and terrible risk. The gangs clearly used these passages to move their human cargo between processing facilities, which meant the paths would be guarded and monitored. But they also represented our only realistic chance of escaping the systematic clearing operations that were closing in around our sector. The alternative was to remain in territory that had already been marked for harvesting, waiting for our turn to join the sordid identification badges that littered the shrine's floor. Sierra had grown noticeably weaker during our time among the corpses, her movements becoming increasingly labored as her body struggled to function on the inadequate nutrition we had been able to scavenge. The infected cut on her arm, which we had been treating with salvaged antiseptic and strips of cloth torn from abandoned clothing, showed signs of spreading despite our efforts. The skin around the wound had taken on a grayish color that I recognized from Medicaid texts as the early stages of systemic infection, and her periodic episodes of fever were becoming more frequent and severe. The reality of our situation was becoming impossible to ignore. Even if we managed to avoid the gangs and reach the upper levels of the hive, Sierra's condition would require medical treatment that was simply not available in the collapsed infrastructure around us. The Medicaid facilities that had once served our sector had been stripped of their equipment and supplies months ago, and the few remaining medical personnel had either fled to more secure areas or had been specifically targeted by gangs who recognized the value of their expertise. I helped her to her feet, supporting her weight as we prepared to leave the shrine and begin what would likely be our final attempt to reach safety. The route I had identified from the gang's crude maps would take us through the heart of their territory, past processing facilities where the screams we had been hearing found their source. But the alternative was to remain in place and wait for the systematic clearing operations to reach our hiding spot, which the evidence suggested would happen within days rather than weeks. The journey through the commercial district's ruins took on a nightmarish quality as we encountered increasingly frequent signs of the gang's industrial approach to human exploitation. Buildings that had once housed legitimate businesses now served as sorting facilities where captured civilians were evaluated and categorized according to their potential value. The efficiency of these operations was evident in the organizational systems that had been established, crude but functional conveyor belts constructed from salvaged machinery, holding areas marked with symbols that indicated different categories of human inventory, and processing stations equipped with tools that had been repurposed from their original industrial applications. The psychological impact of witnessing these facilities was devastating in ways that went beyond simple horror. The systematic nature of the operations, the careful attention to efficiency and waste reduction, the bureaucratic precision with which human beings were reduced to component parts, all of it represented a complete inversion of the values that had once defined imperial civilization. The same organizational principles that had once been used to manufacture lasgun components in service to the Emperor's armies were now being applied to the dismemberment and distribution of his faithful subjects. At one facility, I observed through a broken window as gang members conducted what appeared to be a quality control inspection of their latest harvest. The clinical detachment with which they examined their victims, checking for signs of disease or injury that might affect market value, demonstrated how completely they had embraced their role as entrepreneurs in the trade of human flesh. The conversations I overheard dealt with shipping schedules and inventory management, the mundane logistics of an operation that had grown large enough to require formal coordination between multiple locations. The scope of the network became clearer as we moved deeper into gang territory. Transportation routes connected different processing facilities, allowing for the efficient movement of both raw materials and finished products between locations that specialized in different aspects of the trade. Some buildings had been converted into storage facilities where human flesh was preserved using techniques that combined salvaged refrigeration equipment with traditional methods of meat curing. Others served as distribution centers where products were packaged for shipment to trading partners in distant sectors of the hive. Evidence of these trading relationships appeared in the form of shipping manifests that had been posted on walls throughout the district. The documents, written in the mixture of Low Gothic and Gang Cant that had become the lingua franca of the collapsed economy, detailed transactions involving quantities of human flesh that staggered me with their scale. Entire hab blocks worth of people had been processed and distributed, their lives reduced to line items in ledgers that tracked profit margins and customer satisfaction with the same attention to detail that had once characterized legitimate imperial commerce. The realization that this trade extended beyond the boundaries of our hive came when I discovered communication equipment that was being used to coordinate with off-world contacts. The Vox units were crude but functional, cobbled together from salvaged components that suggested technical expertise that went beyond typical gang capabilities. Transmission logs indicated regular contact with parties that were identified only by code numbers, but the nature of the communications made it clear that the trade in human flesh had become part of a larger economic network that spanned multiple worlds. The implications were terrifying. The collapse of imperial authority on Mordius Prime had not created an isolated pocket of chaos, but had instead opened up new markets for entrepreneurs who specialized in the systematic exploitation of human resources. The gangs were not simply scavenging the ruins of civilization, They were participating in a shadow economy that operated according to supply and demand principles that treated human beings as just another commodity to be harvested and distributed according to market forces. As we approached the vertical transit shaft that represented our only hope of reaching the upper levels, the evidence of systematic exploitation became overwhelming. The route was lined with processing facilities that operated around the clock, their crude lighting systems creating pools of hellish illumination in the perpetual darkness of the lower hive. The sounds that emerged from these buildings, the mechanical noise of improvised cutting equipment, the wet sounds of organic matter being separated into component parts, the occasional human scream that suggested not all victims were processed after death, created an acoustic landscape that would haunt me for whatever remained of my life. The transit shaft itself had been converted into a vertical supply line that served the gang's distribution network. Crude elevators constructed from salvaged materials moved constantly between different levels, carrying cargo that was covered with stained tarps but whose nature was obvious from the shapes beneath the fabric and the smells that emanated from the containers. The operation required coordination between multiple levels of the hive, suggesting that the gangs had established control over territory that extended far beyond the commercial district where we had been hiding. Guards were stationed at regular intervals along the shaft, armed with weapons that ranged from improvised clubs to military-grade lasguns that had obviously been taken from defeated Imperial forces. Their discipline and organization indicated training that went beyond the typical gang structure, suggesting that they had absorbed personnel from collapsed planetary defense force units and had maintained military protocols despite their complete rejection of Imperial authority. The discovery that our route to the upper levels was completely controlled by the gangs forced me to confront the reality that escape was no longer a realistic possibility. The systematic nature of their operations, the scope of their territorial control, and the resources at their disposal made it clear that they had replaced Imperial authority with something that was more efficient and far more ruthless. The upper levels that we had hoped to reach were not zones of safety, but were likely integrated into the same network of exploitation that had consumed everything below. As Sira's condition continued to deteriorate, her fever spiking to levels that made coherent movement increasingly difficult, I was forced to acknowledge that our journey had reached its end. The infection in her arm had spread despite our efforts, and the grayish discoloration was now visible in her fingernails and around her eyes. The medical treatment she needed was not available in the world that had emerged from the collapse of Imperial civilization, and the gangs who controlled the territory around us viewed sick civilians not as people in need of help, but as raw materials whose value had been diminished by contamination. The final revelation came when I discovered that the upper levels of the hive had been sealed by surviving planetary defense force units, not to protect the population below, but to contain what they classified as biological contamination. The sealing protocols had been implemented to prevent the spread of diseases that were running rampant in the lower levels, but the effect was to trap millions of Imperial citizens in a massive tomb where they could be systematically harvested by the gangs who had claimed dominion over the ruins. The bitter irony was inescapable. The same Imperial authorities who had once sworn to protect the civilian population had condemned them to death in order to preserve the upper spire's inhabitants from contamination. The Emperor's protection, which I had believed would extend to all his faithful subjects, had been selectively applied according to calculations that valued some lives over others. The gangs who now ruled the lower levels were not aberrations, but were the logical result of a system that had already abandoned the principles it claimed to represent. Standing in the darkness of the commercial district, supporting Sira's failing body, while listening to the sounds of systematic human exploitation echoing from every direction, I finally understood the true nature of the universe we inhabited. The Emperor's light had never extended to places like this, and the Imperial virtues that had once given meaning to our lives were luxuries that could only be maintained when survival was not in question. The strong consumed the weak not because they were evil, but because that was the fundamental law that governed all existence in a galaxy where war was the only constant. The screams that had haunted our nights were not aberrations, but were the sound of the universe operating according to its true nature. The gangs who processed human flesh with industrial efficiency were not monsters, but were entrepreneurs who had recognized opportunity in the collapse of artificial constraints that had temporarily obscured the brutal reality of existence. The faith that had sustained me through 15 years of loyal service to the Imperium had been nothing more than a comfortable delusion that could not survive contact with the actual conditions of life in the far future. In the grim darkness that surrounded us, there was only war, not the glorious conflict between armies that served competing ideologies, but the slow, grinding war of entropy against order, of hunger against satiety, of desperation against hope. The gangs had won this war not through superior virtue or divine favor, but through their willingness to embrace the brutal pragmatism that survival demanded. They had abandoned the pretense of civilization and had discovered that the universe rewarded such honesty with dominance over those who still clung to obsolete moral frameworks. As Sira's breathing became increasingly labored and the sounds of the processing facilities grew louder around us, I accepted that our story would end here in the darkness of the lower hive. We had sought the Emperor's mercy and had discovered that mercy was another luxury that could not be sustained in a universe governed by the simple mathematics of predator and prey. The only choice that remained was whether to die clinging to illusions that had already been proven false, or to embrace the darkness that had always been the true nature of existence in the far future. The Emperor's final mercy was the revelation that there had never been any mercy at all, only the temporary suspension of the brutal laws that governed all life in a galaxy where hope itself was just another resource to be harvested by those strong enough to claim it. In accepting this truth, I found a strange peace in the knowledge that our suffering had meaning not as a test of faith, but as confirmation of the universe's fundamental indifference to human aspirations. The darkness that consumed us was not evil, but was simply the natural state of things, temporarily obscured by the artificial light of civilizations that were doomed to fail.